that's kind of your personal take on it, rather than seeing it as an outright conspiracy. But there is another way to look at that, correct?
Well, there's the way to look at it in one light is that a lot of the people who are studying and searching for the terrorist financing accounts don't want them looked for and don't want them discovered. They don't
right.
want them known.
So we're talking about a cover-up.
We're talking about a cover-up, and I didn't really know about this until much, much, much later when all of this sort of came to me from Brad Birkenfeld. And it's a weird cosmic world we live in, and coincidences, things kind of fall together. I mean, I look at this as a man of faith, that this is a very spiritual, sort of God-centered happenstance. How I had been down to Central Command as the man in charge of finding terrorist money sources, and then I was kicked off base, and basically later on, I met accidentally the Swiss banker Brad Birkenfeld, who brought me all of the information that the military and the Senate refused to provide me, refused to provide our team. And Brad and I sat down for 6 months and looked at all of this, and I said, Brad, all of this should have come to me and someone in a military uniform. And you're telling me not one time did a military person ever debrief you with your 19,000 bank accounts, that a lot of which belong to Al-Qaeda financiers, terrorist financiers, Saudi Arabians, Qatar, Kuwaitis. No one in a military uniform ever came and conducted any sort of debriefing with you. And Brad said, no, not once, not ever did any military person ever speak with me. In fact, Kevin Downing and Kevin O'Connor at the Department of Justice, the prosecutors, had forbidden Brad from talking to anyone about this material. And I said, well, that's where the smoking gun is, because this material should have gotten to us. It specifically shouldn't have came to me, because that was my job at Booz Allen Hamilton in the military. My job was to basically empty your pockets. You were the golden goose I was looking for. Empty your pockets, and I could have in one night tracked down every terrorist finance bank account, and working in coordination with the Department of Treasury and others, we could have instantly shut down 19,000 accounts and dried up the money source. And the significance of this now is all of the money that perhaps we're seeing going to ISIS in Syria, in the new erupting Islamic State, all of this money could have been shut down in 2010, and we wouldn't have the problem, the issue that we have now. Now, getting back to your point, why was that not done? Well, there's a lot of forces, a lot of agencies, a lot of people that perhaps never wanted it done. They wanted to foment a instability in the Middle East for control. There's a myriad of explanations, but
well, okay,
sticking
but,
to the facts.
Yeah, and that's absolutely somewhere that I want to go in this conversation, but and we can go down that road. But before we do that, I want to make sure that we get the Birkenfeld sort of piece put into this puzzle, and then also the Snowden piece and the Hastings piece, because it's kind of a trajectory. And so
yes.
You're saying it's a coincidence and how things came to a head, and you actually got thrown in jail, of all things,
yes.
For 2 years, if I'm correct.
Yeah.
And I just want to say here, though, that there are no coincidences in my world. And so I have to think that this is fortuitous, and that you have some, we call them white hats behind
yes.
the scenes, that had seen that you had done a good job, seen that you were a good guy and that you were being framed. And they made sure that when you went into prison, you got connected with the right guy. So can you tell that story?
Well, it's certainly the optimistic and I pray truthful underlining a current of all of this. When I returned back to when I left Booz Allen Hamilton at U.S. Central Command, I returned to my Army unit, and I had been it explained that a lot of this was nonsense, and I had requested military counsel to address this matter, and make another direction. When I returned back, Michael Hastings had done a story on General Stanley McChrystal, and he had also done some analysis of Mike Furlong, who was a colleague of mine that I worked with at the State Department, counterterrorism. Mike Furlong had, I will go into a lot of the details of his operations, but had been very successful in generating counterterrorism operations and personnel, and I'd worked closely with him. And when I got back to my Army battalion, our brigade commander, General Burley, had come out and said at a meeting at our battalion, psychological operations is being changed to MISO, Military Information Support Operations, because of Mike Furlong. Anybody hear that name? No one raised their hands. I was the only one, and I went cold because I thought, I know Mike. Where is this coming from? And he went on to talk about Mike Furlong. And Mike Furlong had been targeted by CIA, and they came down on him like a load of bricks because he was so successful in some of his operations. And I had Mike Furley, or I'm sorry, Colonel Burley had also said, in a side to the Furlong issue, we are doing the don't ask, don't tell change in the military. Do you have feedback? And I had written a report in response to that saying, sir, with regards to the don't ask, don't tell, that could be used as a psychological warfare platform for recruiting and destabilizing countries within the Islamic radical cleric establishment. They can propagandize this. So we have to be very cautious in how we unfurl this. And the Obama administration and a lot of people in Congress had made a point to determine that they wanted to move forward with that change. And the significance of this is I wrote a report that's contained in the book in November. It took me a few months to put together, but in November I submitted a report, sent it up to John Boehner and Buck McKeon and all the people in Congress, as well as the Pentagon officials, saying, if we change the don't ask, don't tell policy, here are the negative implications. Here are the radical terrorist Al-Qaeda responses that they will initiate. And it was very thorough. It was very technical material from think tanks was synthesized. So it was a very scholarly report. And my background was in this at the Heritage Foundation, so I knew what I was talking about. And 1 month after submitting that report, which went when a lot of the guys in the military, Colonel Joel Droba in particular, went absolutely bonkers and batshit crazy over. They were furious that I had submitted a report that went against the president's recommendation of changing don't ask, don't tell and allowing homosexuality in the military. And 1 month after submitting that report, I was indicted by the Department of Justice for a base housing application paperwork error. And it was, they shifted that to look like a false statement. I basically filled out some forms for my base housing, which is a questionnaire. And they had charged me 1 month after this report, they charged me with making a false statement, 18100-1, violating a security regulation by not having my guns registered and wearing my uniform without authorization or authority. And the implications of this were quite profound because it represents in the first time in the history of the United States that an active Army officer has been prosecuted by a civilian justice department for wearing his uniform on base during military duties. And I thought it was laughable and besides unconstitutional, but I also knew it was vindictive and motivated by other powers that be. But I had looked at this issue as very important and felt I really had to make this report known to the higher military commanders, for our enlisted men who are on the front lines, for our State Department people who are on the front lines. This is going to have enormous blowback, negative blowback, and you need to be prepared. That was the purpose of writing this report. And the significance of that is 2 years later, Benghazi happened, the Benghazi embassy attacks. And what makes Benghazi directly connected to my report is that the State Department had published a flyer requesting security forces personnel be hired with language that accentuated that homosexuality was not going to be a disqualifier. It was not going to be in any way viewed as negative. In fact, it was encouraged. And the Muslim radical extremists had been rallied to the cleric calls in the Libya area, specifically around some of the materials the State Department were putting out on this. And the fires, if you do the research, the fires that were being ignited, they found the flyer that was produced by the State Department with this language. This flyer asking for security forces personnel with homosexual and not being a disqualifier, those were lit on fire with matches and ignited the fire at Benghazi. When I discovered that later, I thought, my God, I'm not trying to be prophetic, but had you read and looked and appreciated this report, perhaps this could have been altered and changed. Now, they've subsequently invented all sorts of nonsense, such as, well, this was connected to a film, and all that's propaganda. And being a propaganda man, yes. I know what I'm talking about.
Okay, very good. Okay, so at that point, you were thrown into, I mean, did you have a trial?
Yeah, this was in January of 2011, and again, part of me was thinking, this has got to be a test. They're pushing me for some major operation, and they're just seeing how far they can bend me. And I hired a JAG attorney, David Shalala, whose aunt was Donna Shalala, the President Clinton's Health and Human Services Secretary. So David Shalala out of Florida, who was an ex-JAG officer, I hired down there, and I said, this is all nonsense and crazy. I don't know why they're doing this. And he said, just lay low. It'll all go away. It's just they're politically embarrassed, and you've rang the bell with regards to the don't ask, don't tell issue, and you're a round peg in a square hole. And you just lay low, and it'll go away. Well, I laid low. I wasn't trying to start any fights. But next thing I know, the prosecutor, Sarah Sweeney, who was a U.S. Department of Justice prosecutor in Florida, had invented a false affidavit from a Wackenhut security guard at Fort Myer, which was came to me later. I was informed by a colonel that I know very close. I'll keep him anonymous. Wackenhut is a strong CIA affiliate. This Wackenhut guard had invented a false affidavit saying I had impersonated a police officer at Fort Myer in Washington, D.C. And I told my attorney, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. If I wanted to go on a military base, I'd flash my military ID any time of the day. I don't need to dress up as a police officer. Get the tapes. You'll see whoever it was certainly was not me. But that opens up a very strong weirdness. So the CIA, Wackenhut, and this prosecutor, Department of Justice Sarah Sweeney, cobbled together this fantasy that I had dressed up in a police officer uniform, probably to try and get momentum with these other absurd charges. So I go down with my attorney, expecting this whole thing to be thrown out to a magistrate judge. And the magistrate judge, my attorney had either out of ineptitude and incompetence and ineffective assistance to counsel, filed a motion to suppress all evidence. What he should have done was filed a motion to dismiss based on constitutional grounds, saying this man is an Army officer. It is unconstitutional and illegal for the Department of Justice to have jurisdiction over anything that is conducted on a military base. He is performing military duties in uniform. You do not have the jurisdiction to prosecute him. These laws do not apply to him. If the military wanted to charge him, they would have. They never did. Instead, this somehow got passed over to the Obama administration Department of Justice, and they have taken an administrative paperwork error and made it into a federal crime. And they've charged me with wearing my uniform, which means they can basically go to anybody who wears their uniform who's an active reservist who goes to school and visits his daughter after coming back from war. They can prosecute him with the same charge that they've done to me. But I'm confident all of this will eventually be overturned. But in the meantime, I've had to suffer through this. But we appear to the magistrate judge and present a motion to suppress. And the judge said, no, I'm going to let this go to trial. Well, that was the first mistake. We should have appealed and said, you have no jurisdiction. You can't do this. And I couldn't talk about a lot of what I was doing. One, out of concern to the military, I didn't want to open up a Pandora's box. A lot of the material I was doing was top secret related, so I kind of had my hands tied behind my back. And we went to trial, and I had contacted my attorney and said, put me on trial. Here's all of my paperwork. Here's all the documentation that establishes me as being down there for legitimate reasons, and everything that they're trying to charge me with, they can't charge me with. We also had a professional witness who was a military major who had been 30 years in the military, who came down and appeared as my expert witness, who basically said to the judge, none of the charges that you're trying to charge Bennett with, making a false statement, wearing his uniform without authority, and security violation for his guns, none of these are in contradiction with military law. And here's why. So he's presenting this, but yet the judge and the prosecutor are allowed to move forward on this. And they get me in front of a civilian jury. And this is right after the Fort Hood thing had happened. And, you know, the jury, of course, are a little bit like frightened kittens anyway. And they see all of a sudden the prosecutor bring in a Air Force major dressed in an Air Force uniform, which is, again, violation, because you have an Air Force major prosecuting me, an Army officer. That had never happened before in the United States history. So anyway, they put me through a trial. My lawyer didn't put me on the stand. He should have. He didn't present any of the evidence that I gave him. He should have. The jury found me guilty of these three charges. And I instantly thought, okay, they're going to let me appeal this, and now I can go and get military counsel and get this whole thing straightened out. No. The prosecutor at that point had said to the judge, we have an affidavit saying he dressed up in a police uniform. Well, the judge, thinking a police uniform, says, where is that material? And the prosecutor says, we're having trouble with our witness. We're no longer going to present that. It was all false in the beginning, in the first place. But they had poisoned the judge's mind, giving them the false impression that I dressed up in a police uniform. The judge, thinking this guy's, you know, trying to dress up and shoot up a base or something, puts me in prison. And I was in prison for the next 5 months, writing and trying to get to military authorities to have this rectified. And I show up at sentencing and I explain to the judge, this is a massive misunderstanding. I fired my first attorneys and I've requested court counsel because of the miserable job that they've done in misrepresenting me. And I'm going to appeal it. And the judge gave me an enhancement from 1 to 7 months, should have been my guidelines, gave me an enhancement of 36 months. So instantly sent me to prison.
Unbelievable.
So I never, done anything and thought this was a big misunderstanding. But this is where the silver lining of the cloud, of course, opens up that's presented in the book. I go on a bumpy bus wrapped in shackles and an orange jumpsuit, and I make my way up to Federal Prison Camp Schuylkill in Pennsylvania, and where doctors, lawyers, engineers, tax guys are, federal camp. And I meet Brad Birkenfeld. Brad Birkenfeld was the UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, whistleblower who had come to he had been imprisoned, but he had brought to the Department of Justice all of the tax account information, Swiss bank accounts funding terrorism, Swiss bank accounts not being brought to the IRS, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in any case, I sit down with Brad Birkenfeld, and for the next 6 months, we go over every document, every experience on his timeline, and came up with an amazing story that just meshed perfectly with what I had been doing at U.S. Central Command. And to make long story short, I said, Brad, you are the man I was looking for. All of this material and information I could have used, and the military could have used, to win the war, to empty the bank accounts that are being used to fund all of these terrorist operations. And he said, Scott, never, ever did any military person ever come and debrief me. Now, Brad went on to tell me his whole story, which I'm happy to jump into and tell you what he said, if you want.
Yes, yeah. I think that would be very good. I think that people need to understand and hear the story that links up to him actually, you know, flying over to the U.S. to present his material, how he was treated, and the link up with Vanity Fair and that phone call, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, it's we'll start off again, in sort of a movie, so people, it's important for people to kind of write this down on a piece of white paper, because there are so many different personalities, but they slowly begin to coagulate into the center, and you see all their interconnectedness. But Brad Birkenfeld, wonderful man, one of the brightest men I've ever met, extremely sharp, was in Switzerland as the Union Bank of Switzerland banker, who was discovering a lot of funny business that was going on with Union Bank of Switzerland. Things were tied to U.S. politicians, things that were tied to Geithner and a lot of people in the Obama administration, and as well as the Republicans. And Brad had been making a lot of noise in the Union Bank of Switzerland hierarchy, professional hierarchy, about problems and issues. Well, he had been approached by some people who, make a long story short, had got him out, went to a bar, got him drunk, and got him stopped with a DUI, the same thing that they tried to pin on me. DUI charge, he was put in jail, and next thing he knows, the people that had approached him came into the jail cell in Switzerland, Geneva, flashed a CIA badge, and got him out. Approached him for information and tried to recruit him, and Brad, getting nervous and wary of it, goes over to the United States with his bag of material information to release to as a whistleblower. Now, what's significant about that is Edward Snowden and his material revealed to Glenn Greenwald in 2013, his first interview, which you can look at, said his turning point was when he was a Geneva CIA analyst and he saw the Swiss banker Brad Birkenfeld being targeted for CIA recruitment in a phony DUI. So Snowden is up here, and he sees Birkenfeld being targeted by the CIA. That's pretty significant. So you build the bridge between the two of them right there. Edward Snowden, Brad Birkenfeld. Brad then packs his bags, flees like a bat out of hell to get out of there, and comes over to the United States and goes to the Department of Justice, sits down with Kevin Downing and Kevin O'Connor, and says, I've got all this information about terrorist financing and Swiss banks and accounts and Abdullah Aziz, a major al-Qaeda financier. I want to give it, but I can't give it without a subpoena. You have to subpoena me. And the Department of Justice said to him, you're not a whistleblower, you're a tipster. And they refused to give him a subpoena. They refused to hear any of his information. They refused to take any of the papers that he had, which were incredibly significant. 19,000 bank accounts, lots of which are belonging to bad guys in the Middle East right now that have been used over the last 5, 6, 7 years to kill Americans and our allies. So the Department of Justice don't want any of that. They don't want to talk to him. They won't give him a subpoena. So he runs right over across the street to the IRS. And the IRS, again, this is all information that Brad has told me and sat down with me over 6 months, and we've diagrammed it and written down exhaustively. He goes over to the IRS. The IRS refused to give him a subpoena. So that's significant. So he next goes over to the United States Senate into Carl Levin's office, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And they give him a subpoena. He goes in. He testifies behind closed doors on all of the material that he has. And next thing he knows, he returns to Switzerland or something. And he tells a very significant story. And that is when he was over giving a lot of this material, he was, I think, flying back and forth. He had a friend who was a London banker who had a Middle Eastern name, who was on his way to Mexico and called Brad up and said, hey, I'm going to Mexico. Where are you? I'm in the United States. He said, great, I'll pick you up. Now, this is a rich, very wealthy banker. He has his own private plane. He flies down into the United States, picks Brad up. They go to Mexico, have a good time, and flies back. Well, that banker in London had been written a letter, and that letter, Brad showed me a copy, and I have a copy of it. The letter had said, Brad Birkenfeld is releasing information. That letter had been written to UBS. This letter had been written to UBS saying Brad Birkenfeld is giving information to the American authorities. And it was signed his friend's name. UBS had called Brad's friend and said, "Why did you send us this letter?" And his friend had said, "I never sent you any sort of a letter." And UBS had faxed him a copy of this letter, and it said, July 2007, to Union Bank of Switzerland from Mohammed, whatever his name was, Brad Birkenfeld is giving information to the American authorities. You should be advised. And Brad's friend said, "I never sent this letter." And he called Brad up and said, "What is this all about? I just got a letter that was forged." And Brad said, I can't go into it, but send me a copy of the letter." He sent Brad a copy of the letter. Brad went in with his lawyer and said to the Department of Justice, "What is this?" And the Department of Justice, Kevin Downing, Kevin O'Connor, "Well, we don't know. We'll investigate it." They never did. It disappeared. What's significant about that is the only way that that could have transpired is if Brad Birkenfeld had walked into the Department of Justice, gave his cell phone and his email and all that information, saying, "Here's what I've got, contact me." They then in turn took that, and I've written this up in my analysis, which was presented September 25th, 2012, to military commanders in the Congress. That material was then given to CIA, NSA, and they tracked Brad, tracked his friend, flying in from Europe, picking him up and going to Mexico. They tracked that information and used that information to cobble a false, fraudulent letter and sent that to Union Bank of Switzerland, hoping that Brad, when he returned, would be killed, thrown in jail, something. And that struck me as very profound. So you do have the intelligence agencies and the Department of Justice working in tandem just on Brad's situation alone, where they're tracking him and they cobble this false letter together. Well, in any case, that's significant. But the Department of Justice approached Brad and said, "We're going to indict you for conspiracy because you didn't tell us everything pertaining to your various clients, such as Alenikov." And Brad had said, "Excuse me, I did tell you this. I told it in the Senate testimony. Go back and you'll see it. In fact, you emailed me prior. My attorneys advised you that I did release that information." And they said, "Oh, yes, well, we'll check into it." And they came back later and said, "No, well, we're going to indict you for conspiracy based on the Alenikov issue." And Brad said, "Well, get my transcript from the Senate testimony and you'll see I revealed that." And they told him, "No, we cannot because they are sealed. And because they're sealed, you can't use them as defense." And Brad had no way to defend himself. It was his word against their sealed transcripts.
Incredible.
Now, that's significant, too, because they did the same thing to Joe Nocio. Joe Nocio was the CEO of Quest Communications, who had been involved with NSA phone issues just prior to 9/11. A lot of this is open source material. So you can Google and look up Joe Nocio and a lot of the story behind that. And he had been approached by the NSA to release a lot of the information on clients for Quest Communications, and he refused to do that. And Quest Communications subsequently dried up his contracts. He sold stock. Next thing you know, they come at him for insider trading. And he said, "All this material is in the transcripts about NSA, coming to me, asking me to do this, and I wouldn't do it." And they said, "No, those transcripts are sealed."
Incredible.
And
yeah,
they threw charges at him, and he had to cop a plea because they said, "We'll face 20 years or give you 5. And a man who's married with children, they make a pretty quick decision, go for the 5. But that's an illustrated version of their tactic of sealing material, sealing information, and then forcing the person into a plea bargain. They did that to Brad. They did it to Joe Nocio. Joe Nocio's son was in Georgetown and had been stabbed in the arm by two men in suits who said, "Say hi to your dad for us." So there are some real dark elements and dark characters involved here. And I know your audience is sufficiently intellectually equipped to appreciate that and probably have far more interesting research levels of that than I do. But all of this came to me through unclassified sources and directly from word of mouth who the people who it happened to. And when you sit down with someone and look them eye to eye for months on end and they tell you this story exhaustively from every angle, you know it's true, and you can see it together. I had come from the terrorist counterterrorism threat finance analyst, so I saw all the connections that Brad Birkenfeld had been bringing.
Okay, so, but what about the phone call, the Vanity Fair story?
Yeah, that was interesting. Brad was in a limo with a Vanity Fair author, journalist, who was writing a story. Brad had a lot of material he was putting forth. 60 Minutes was doing an interview with him because he was mad as hell that they were doing this to him. Here's a man coming to the United States government about every piece of information relating to terrorist bank accounts run by Switzerland, run by UBS, and various other Swiss banks. He has 19,000 bank accounts waiting to give them to say, use these materials to track down terrorists and, among other things, help our government, help the American people and the American taxpayer. He brings all that information to them, and they do nothing. Well, he's talking to journalists and putting materials together, and a Vanity Fair journalist is with him in the limousine, and he says, Brad, I just got a text from the CIA substation chief telling me not to do this story. And Brad says, what? He said, yep. And he's looking at his phone. He said, the guy is telling him, Karzai is much worse. Do not do the Birkenfeld UBS story. So right then and there, you see CIA telling a Vanity Fair journalist not to do anything with regards to Birkenfeld, his Swiss bank accounts, his terrorist finance connections. And that blew me away when I heard that too. So
right. Brad, so, well, that's important because that shows the hand of the CIA over major media, which is, this is a commonplace actually behind the scenes.
Yeah. So that was appalling, frightening at the same time. But Brad goes in to court and they sentence him to 40 months in prison. And he's blown away. He fires his attorney and goes through all sorts of trying appeal stuff. And the criminal justice system takes years to get your appeals. It's like a wheel of fortune. It takes an enormous amount of time to get them back up in front. But he's sentenced to prison for 40 months. And he goes to Schuylkill up in Pennsylvania. Well, lo and behold, like your point, I am sentenced to 36 months. And I'm sent up to Pennsylvania, and that's where I meet Brad, and we sit down and we compare notes, and it was, everything falls together. And like I had written, it was almost like an operation where I had been specifically commissioned to go in and obtain the bank account information for Abdullah Aziz and a variety of other Al-Qaeda financiers and Middle East financiers and all the material pertaining to UBS and its Swiss banking accounts. Had I been a commission to do that, this would have been the perfect example of a successful mission because that's exactly what I got. And I sat down with Brad and we put together letters and materials and I mean, we couldn't believe what was happening and what we had discovered together. And we had sent a letter to General James Mattis of U.S. Central Command. And I told Brad, here are all the people that we need to contact about this. This is significant and important. Me as a military officer, this is material that my commanders at USACAPOC, General Jeff Jacobs and General Mattis, need to be know about. And because I had asked Brad, no one has ever approached you or talked to you about this information. Never. We need to get it out. So we put the letter together, sent it down to General Mattis. Brad then got out of prison, and he was very concerned for his safety. He was going through Cohn and Colapinto, his lawyers in D.C., and 1 month after submitting that letter, he was paid $104 million. And Brad has never been heard from since and has went underground and been very quiet. My speculation is he's been warned off, he's been threatened and in no uncertain terms not to discuss about any of this material.
Okay, now at a certain point, and if you have something to add there, then go ahead. But I'm going to, kind of try to move this along a bit quicker because it's excellent what you're covering. And I'm hoping that people are listening, understanding this trail and how important it is because it reveals a lot of things, not just, that you were framed and that he was framed and that, the inner workings really, but how a cover up happens and how what people call conspiracy theory, this is actually a conspiracy, and this is how the conspirators are acting upon you guys who are actually trying to do the right thing,
yeah.
the good thing, and report the truth. Now, there is a link up, however, to not only Michael Hastings, but also to Edward Snowden
yeah.
and his the journalists at The Guardian. And you submitted your material to them, and there was a stop there as well, and I'd like to reveal that here.
The letter that Brad had sent out to General Mattis after he was paid off, I then took and formulated a report to General Jeffrey Jacobs saying, "Sir, this material has just been revealed to me. I was still an officer in the United States Army. I'm in a federal civilian prison as an active Army Reserve officer," which is the first time in the history of the United States that's ever been done. They basically, the Army never charged me with anything, yet the Civilian Justice Department comes in and charges me. Now, what's interesting is that Lanny Brewer, the assistant U.S. attorney, assistant attorney general, and Eric Holder both work for a firm called Covington & Burling. Covington & Burling represented Union Bank of Switzerland and a variety of other international banks and organizations. So Lanny Brewer and Eric Holder leave Covington and Burling and join the Obama administration. And they then prosecute Brad Birkenfeld, who's making a lot of noise about UBS. Now, Brad Birkenfeld also brought a lot of WikiLeaks material, WikiLeaks cables. Julian Assange, God bless him, brings a lot of material that comes from the State Department and others that clearly state under Hillary Clinton that Brad Birkenfeld is going to be used as a scapegoat and Swiss concessions are going to be appropriated if we basically sell Brad Birkenfeld down the river. So the United States government under Hillary Clinton at the Department of State, in coordination with Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer, focus on Brad Birkenfeld to make him a scapegoat and target and prosecute him for material that he's bringing to the American people to help them and help the government. So Lanny Brewer, Eric Holder, and Hillary Clinton come at Brad, and this is all in the WikiLeaks cables. That's Brad brought all those to me and showed me them, and I have a lot of experience with military and State Department cables. I said, "Brad, you'd be amazed, but see this cable right here, which identifies you and all this? This comes from State Department Counterterrorism in 2008. I was at the State Department Counterterrorism Office in 2008. So all of the material that was relevant, I was there. I was part of the organization and the team. But my report went up September 25th, 2012. Edward Snowden, who was a Booz Allen Hamilton contractor working out of Hawaii, who knew and was overseen by one of my friends who worked at Booz Allen. I won't name who it is, but he worked under the management of guys that I knew at Booz Allen.
Including Mike McConnell
in U.S. Cyber Command. I knew all the people that he was working with, and I knew
just for my listeners, there's a direct link between Mike McConnell, who was basically named by Dan Burish in an interview and behind the scenes with us numerous times as the head of MJ-12 for the mm-hmm. listeners. So you see there's a direct link between Booz Allen Hamilton and MJ-12 and what I would say is the secret space program and the Black Projects, where a lot of this this money is being waylaid, so to speak. To get back to the story here, so your report somehow...
My report bounced through the TSSCI communication channels, the Nippernet, the Cippernet, and Edward Snowden saw it, read it, and recognized Brad Birkenfeld in it, and thereby recognized his own position in it as the Geneva, Switzerland CIA analyst, and all the bells went off. He saw Birkenfeld targeted by UBS, or CIA, NSA, Department of Justice, recognized that he was the Swiss banker that was targeted for a DUI, saw my report as a military officer in as a terrorist finance analyst and a Booz Allen Hamilton contractor and recognized me and my name in the Booz Allen directory and basically chose to take the money and run and took all of the reports he could and began to do his exodus, which 8 months later, involved him flying out of Hawaii, going to Hong Kong and revealing it to Glenn Greenwald, and then making his continued journey on to Ecuador that has been temporarily stopped by Russia. So he's conveniently in Russia. But that was significant because it draws the three-level connection, the three-legged stool of Birkenfeld in Switzerland, Snowden in Switzerland, and Bennett in Booz Allen Hamilton military terrorist financing. So Snowden and I are connected by the terrorist financing Booz Allen Hamilton connection, and Brad is connected with me because of our joint experience in the federal prison camp, and Brad having all the Swiss banking information that I found enormously informative and valuable. That was, I mean, just you could, it was like finding a treasure on the seashore. And Snowden had seen a lot of this. Now, this is the other interesting thing, is Jessel and Raddick, who you see coming out with Kirk Wiebe and Thomas Drake and Snowden. She's, in fact, I think Snowden's direct attorney, had represented Brad Birkenfeld as well. And Brad had talked to her just when he got out and said, you need to contact Bennett because he is the military expert who will confirm a lot of my financial terrorist account information from UBS. So Jessalyn Raddick is the connection also at the center to Birkenfeld, Snowden, and myself. She knows all three of us. A lot of this material hasn't really gotten out until now. You're the first intrepid reporter, really, to begin to expose this and identify it. And I don't think it's enormously complex. I think it's just been a lot of fear. Michael Hastings also was looking into this and had gotten reports. And we know what happened to him subsequently later. I think he was drawing the connections between – I think he had angered a lot of McChrystal's people that perhaps, you know, used that as an excuse to take him out. But it was told to me that he was taken out with a thermite charge in his vehicle. And he – it's significant that he was looking into this. And what is most significant is this story shows that – the United States government under the Department of Justice, Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, who were working for Covington & Burling, which is the law firm that represented UBS, and Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, coordinated the targeted prosecution of Birkenfeld. And all of the financial accounts that he came to the Senate with to say, give these to the military, give these to the terrorist finance experts to track down the terrorist money sources that could be going to bad guys in the future, which now we see that future is ISIS in Syria, in the Middle East, through Kuwait, through Qatar, through Saudi Arabia. All those accounts we had in 2009. Actually, we had them in 2007, 2008.
And okay, but we still – okay, there's still the link up with the Guardian reporter, because Greenwald – had an assistant that you submitted this material to who basically seemed to have sat on it. Is that correct?
Yeah. Andrew Fishman is his name. He is Glenn Greenwald's assistant. And Andrew Fishman had contacted me after I had, again, I sent my material out to over 100 senators and congressmen. As a military officer, I'm writing letters saying, dear members of Congress, I'm a United States Army officer being held in a prison. And the material that I am presenting to you directly relates to terrorism, terrorist financing. Please debrief me. Please immediately contact me. This is not an ice cream man or a car mechanic. This is an officer of the United States Army who's worked with a top secret SCI clearance at the State Department, at Special Operations Command, at Central Command, at Booz Allen Hamilton, at the Bush Administration, at Heritage Foundation, with a bachelor's, with a master's, with a PhD. Who has got something to say? Don't you think you should pay attention to him? Not one person except Rand Paul ever responded, ever looked into this. In fact, there were vilifying attempts. Senator Jim Nelson in Florida. Florida is where a lot of it happened, so there's something funny there. Was after this letter, which I read in the beginning, had submitted to Senator Feinstein, Senator Jim Nelson jumps on and starts berating me and telling Senator Feinstein, we don't know what this guy knows. We don't know who he is. Basically trying to say we need to get rid of him or silence him or keep him in prison. But no one in the United States military or the Congress ever contacted me or Birkenfeld about these materials. It was extremely significant.
Okay.
Andrew Fishman at the Glenn Greenwald, his assistant, had said, do you have proof that these documents exist and Birkenfeld is connected with the Snowden revelations? And I said, absolutely, I have proof. I have everything documented. Contact me for details. I'm happy to send it to you. Meet me. And I never heard from Andrew Fishman again after that. So I would hope that it was a ineptitude, bureaucratic blunder, failure. But something's very funny when Glenn Greenwald, the quote, supposed champion of getting the Snowden information out, doesn't contact, you know, the very source that says Edward Snowden and Brad Birkenfeld are connected. And it's significant because Brad Birkenfeld is the number one Union Bank of Switzerland guy who was throughout all the news in 2009 about tax accounts. Now, they've subsequently spun his whole issue to be more about, you know, off tax havens for the rich and all that. That was only part of the argument. The main thrust of his revelations were these Swiss bank accounts were being used to fund terrorism, and I'm taking $19,000 and I'm presenting them to the Department of Justice so that we can begin to track them down, so that we don't lose more soldiers, so that we win the war. So he came from a patriotic duty. That was my whole impetus. But yet, no one in the government, no one in the military had ever done anything about it. And I think that's what motivated Snowden to take his material and go directly to the public. He saw what happened to us, and he also saw what happened to Bill Wiebe and Thomas Drake. And Benny and
okay, but Birkenfeld has been silent. And is he still living in Switzerland? Do you know?
No, Brad is in New Hampshire, and he's keeping a very low profile. They had subsequently approached him and tried to ensnare him with another DUI, apparently, and perhaps that was a threat. To say, you better not say a single thing that corroborates any of Bennett's materials or any of this stuff, because they realized the cat was out of the bag, the thing was frothing beyond a level they could contain, and all the material has already been downloaded and is out there, and Brad is in New Hampshire keeping a low profile. I think his lawyers had said, wait until we can get you out of the country to be safe.
Okay, now the Swiss bank accounts, that's something like, what, 19, did you say 19,000?
19,000 bank accounts.
That's just astronomical. Now,
not
I assume
just,
that...
Not just individual, these are charities, these are every entity, every organization, every middleman, every individual donor. The biggest one was Abdullah Aziz. And, I mean, Brad gave me copies of all that material. Abdullah Aziz was a major al-Qaeda financier, Saudi connection. All of that material was gold that was never used, except 4,000 accounts, and the rest have I think, intentionally been allowed to disappear. And the tragedy is all of those bank accounts, when the bad guys started getting a whiff, basically when they went public and said, we're prosecuting Birkenfeld, all the bad guys' money they took and they hid, as well as, I think, CIA accounts, they just reshuffled the deck.
Okay, but those accounts and the documentation that goes with them, I assume, is this either part of your book or your backup materials, or is it secreted away somewhere by Birkenfeld?
A lot of this is secreted away. Birkenfeld has copies of a lot of this material. A lot of this material that he's given me specifically related to the individual accounts and the banks and such, I haven't wanted to release into anything until it's safely, thoroughly vetted with lawyers and military officials. But I have uploaded everything and safely distributed it to people that I trust. Should anything happen to me, all of it would come out, and you could rest assured that you would get a copy of it.
Okay, well, thank you for that. So at this moment, you know, I'd like to ask you some questions that may seem kind of coming out of nowhere, but I want to make sure that you've been able to get out, at least in this forum, the way we're doing it, you know, with somebody reading your materials and your book and all of this, putting it together. Is there any other sort of threads that we've sort of forgotten to mention?
Well, we've got the Brad Birkenfeld connection with UBS and his story of being targeted by the CIA in a false DUI charge and running over here as a result of that with his suitcase of banking information, and Snowden being in Geneva, Switzerland at the time witnessing all of this and reporting to Glenn Greenwald later that that was his turning point when he saw the Swiss banker being targeted. That's significant. Then Brad comes over and its connection with Department of Justice. They're taking his information and targeting his friend in London who flies over and picks him up and then fraudulently form a letter, send it to UBS to try and have him in jailed or assassinated. And that's hugely significant because that affirms the entire fear or you know suspicion that people have about the whole NSA CIA surveillance of citizens, because what happened to Brad is the nightmare instinct that every American has felt, which is I don't want people reading my email or targeting my phone calls because they could give it to the Department of Justice and prosecute me with some cobbled together crime. That's right. Exactly what they did to Brad Birkenfeld. And it's startling because here he comes into the Department of Justice, a department that you grow up in America hoping and expecting that your Department of Justice is like Captain America. They're for truth and they're for righteousness and they're for protecting citizens' rights. And they do exactly the opposite. They target a good American with a deadly game and try and have it assassinated. Next thing you see, the CIA telling a Vanity Fair journalist not to run the Birkenfeld story. And 60 Minutes and everyone else drop the story. Vanity Fair drops the story. And Birkenfeld conveniently is sentenced to 40 months for being the man who brings all this information up front. And yet he's put in prison.
Well, so, I mean, that's exactly the same trajectory that happened to you, in essence. You were bringing forward information that was crucial. Making, you know, if anything, just warning, giving warnings with documentation, with, you know, with your area of expertise in certain reports that you're giving. And then that's being actually turning you into a target. So here you're doing your job. And on the other hand, you're being targeted by the very people you're reporting to. Now, I don't know if you can implicate, for example, Dov Zakheim, or whether there are certain, you know, top generals that you feel were sort of implicated, if you will, in the trajectory that you're on, or whether you want to even go down that road to mentioning them. But it may be instructional for one thing. Yeah, and then I think you're also saying that the Obama administration at a certain point is culpable here.
Oh, absolutely.
And so that has to mean, I mean, we do think the Eric Holder, as you've even stated to me, is quite possibly stepping down because this is getting too hot. And then you're even seeing a trail to Benghazi. So, you know, Hillary Clinton's certainly implicated.
Oh.
There have to be some other players that you haven't named who are equally implicated. I mean, I don't know. You know, you don't
Here's one thing, and a lot of this I've written down exhaustively and put it all in it, but it comes to me again that some of the things we haven't mentioned, for example, Senator President Barack Obama, when he was Senator Barack Obama, was on the Senate Investigations Committee that heard Birkenfeld. So Barack Obama, when he was a senator, was on Carl Levin's Senate Committee on Permanent Investigations and heard all of this material on terrorist financing through Swiss banks and UBS. So Obama heard it all. He was there. And it's very suspicious that all this happened to Brad when Obama became president. And also suspicious is that Robert Wolf, the chairman of UBS for the Americas, became Barack Obama's fundraising guy in 2008. So the guy in charge of UBS for all of the Americas comes over and joins Obama's team, giving him money. In exchange for what? For making Brad Birkenfeld a scapegoat, for telling Lanny Breuer and Eric Holder to prosecute Brad Birkenfeld, and telling Hillary Clinton to aid in securing Swiss treaties in exchange for prosecuting Birkenfeld. That's a pretty significant story. That's why Brad was really mad as a hornet that they were all coming to him and trying to dogpile on him for giving information that was in the national interest of the United States. And that's where you can judicially and legally look at this to say, is this treason? Is this in violation of constitutional government powers?
Absolutely.
Profoundly, I think so. I think with you have some brilliant lawyers step in and really examine and articulate a lot of this material and pull in Birkenfeld's story, my story, and Snowden's story, and it creates the perfect storm. You have three fronts that come together. Now, I found it very significant that Eric Holder has just resigned in the last few days, and Dov Zakheim made an appearance on Russia Today yesterday. First time I'd seen him. Suddenly he pops up just after I agreed to do this interview with you. Eric Holder just resigns after I agreed to do this interview with you.
And not only that, but you and I both know that Russia Today called you to try to scoop me, as journalists call it, last night when they obviously got wind that we were going to do this interview today. So they wanted you to go on the air, immediately. And so wanted to circumvent, I guess, or cut this, whatever they wanted to do, spin it their way. But I want to ask about the other Swiss banks, because isn't it true that there are other Swiss banks that are also implicated in this sort of money trail?
Absolutely. And that was the beauty of Birkenfeld's material. He brought together all of the intelligence that, as an intelligence analyst, I could have laid out on a big white table and had basically the whole World War II outline of all my major targets. And those were Credit Suisse, HSBC, besides all the other European banks and Middle Eastern sub-banks and contractors that are used by the Swiss banks. He brought a wealth of material. He had worked in the Swiss banking area for like 10 years. He knew where all the bodies were buried. He knew all the major bankers and their phones, their cell phones, their hotel rooms and their calendars of events and when they come and their conferences and their clients. He had enormous a wealth of information that staggered my mind because I was just blown away. And he also had all of the WikiLeaks cables that he couldn't quite make sense of, but me and my background with them, I'm looking at them. And it's like looking into one of those photographs you have to stare at for a long time, and suddenly you see the image on the other side. That was what I saw when Brad bought all this stuff to me. Suddenly I studied it, and I could see the multidimensional connections and the people and the agencies, and I was flabbergasted. I was appalled, and that's what triggered me, again, out of a sense of patriotism as an officer of the United States Army. How is this information being used to protect my enlisted soldiers on the battlefield, my Marines, my special operations, my CIA assets? How are we utilizing this?
And that's where we leave the interview due to time constraints. There's 1 hour left, which is quite informative stuff. I may well put it into a future episode if I can find some material to accompany it. If you'd like to download this or any previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests, you can do so from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. It will be interesting to see whether commercially controlled media has anything at all to say about revelations of Scott Bennett, but I, for one, am not holding my breath. Quite an interesting contrast with the different responses evinced by Edward Snowden. To help these poor